Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The most recent point-in-time count of Sacramento's unhoused population backs up what we see and experience on a daily basis. The homelessness crisis continues to deepen. The numbers reveal a 67% increase since 2019. Over 9,000 people on any given night are experiencing homelessness in Sacramento County, and that's likely a conservative number. 2 years ago, the X Street Navigation Shelter, it opened to serve an area just south of downtown Sacramento with some of the highest concentrations of encampments. The goal is to connect as many people with affordable housing options. But a recent check-in by CAP Radio's homelessness and housing affordability reporter Chris Nichols reveals that while the shelter has made somewhat successful progress, there are still serious barriers that remain between the unhoused population and a permanent place to call home. Chris joins us now. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Vicky. It's great to be here.
So you decided to revisit the X Street Homeless Shelter 2 years after reporting its opening. So what sets this shelter apart?
I think X Street really stands out as an important resource in the city's effort to solve the immediate crisis on the streets, especially the large number of homeless camps, as you talked about, up and down the WX corridor south of downtown. It is a low barrier shelter. And that means people can come as they are, with their pets, with their possessions and partners. They cannot consume drugs or alcohol on site, but at the same time, they don't have to maintain sobriety to stay at the shelter.
Why did you decide to check in on the shelter this fall?
I wanted to learn how well the shelter was doing, not just in bringing people in off the streets. I think that's really important, but how are they doing connecting them with housing? You know, whenever a new shelter is proposed or open, we often cover it here at CAP Radio. Advocates for unhoused residents will usually express caution. They want to make sure these facilities aren't warehousing people, but instead getting them the services and ultimately the housing they need. And that was the goal that was expressed 2 years ago when I originally toured the shelter with Amani Sawirs. At the time, she was the chief operating officer of the local chapter of Volunteers of America. That's the nonprofit that operates the X Street shelter. And here is what she told me 2 years ago.
This is not a traditional shelter. It's a navigation center, and we are navigating people to housing and the services that they need to get the housing and stay housed. We usually average about 6 months, but it could be in any direction. It is our goal to serve 200 people out of the shelter in the first year. It is our goal to get the majority of those people housed. Some people aren't going to be ready, and we will have planted a seed, and they'll go do something else, but the seed will be planted. And I consider that a success. So it just depends on where they are.
Okay, so the operative word is a navigation shelter. Housing is the ultimate goal. So how is the shelter doing in getting people into housing?
Well, it's definitely bringing people in off the street. It's served nearly 800 people during its first 2 years, and many are from the surrounding neighborhood. It's also made some progress in housing people, but the city's own data shows that the vast majority of people who come in are not connected with housing. So far, about 35% have been linked to some form of housing, either permanent or temporary. And that is certainly not the majority of people that Sawirs had hoped for. When I asked the city's housing authority about the expectations for connecting people with housing, they said they set a lower goal of getting about 40% housed.
So how does this performance at the X Street shelter compare with rehousing efforts at other shelters?
Well, I think just based on my experience with this, the struggle to get people into housing, it seems pretty universal, no matter which shelter you're talking about in the Sacramento region. And I know we'll talk about some of the reasons why later in this segment. But as an example, Sacramento's Meadowview Shelter for Women, it opened 1 year before X Street. And so far, its numbers show about the same thing. Roughly 32% of its guests are getting connected to housing. And again, that means the vast majority who enrolled are just still at the shelter waiting for housing, or they may have left the shelter without ever getting connected to it. I asked Bob Erlenbush about the rehousing efforts at X Street. He's a prominent advocate for the unhoused community. He leads the Sacramento Regional Coalition to End Homelessness. And Erlenbush says, at least when it comes to finding permanent housing, which of course is the ideal and usually comes with a lease and some tenant protections, the X Street shelter is on par with most other shelters across the region, moving about 18 or 19% into permanent housing.
I would say that they're performing exactly the same. 18% seems to be sort of the mark for programs' abilities to place people into permanent housing. It's okay. Exactly the same percentage as all the programs that report to Sacramento Steps Forward that does its annual reports to HUD.
Erlenbush referenced Sacramento Steps Forward. That's a nonprofit that helps plan and coordinate the region's homeless services.
Okay, so given that, you know, roughly one in five people are getting into permanent housing, and that is on par with surrounding shelters, you know, people may be listening to that and hearing that and being like, that doesn't sound good as our this population continues to grow. So let's talk about why most people are not getting into housing after spending time at the shelters, one of which is a navigation shelter. I mean, what are those reasons?
Right. And I imagine some of those numbers are kind of frustrating because it essentially means that people are moving back to the streets, not in all cases, but in many cases. You know, there's really a wide range of factors why housing connections don't work. You know, there are a lot of financial and logistical challenges. At the X Street shelter, about 40% of the guests who arrive need help securing an ID or a social security card or disability paperwork, essentially the documents that they need just to apply for housing and benefits. Nearly half of the people who came to the shelter had no income whatsoever. But of course, money is not the only obstacle. Many unhoused residents, they face serious physical and sometimes mental health challenges. More than three quarters of the people who entered the X Street program reported having a disability, according to figures tracked by the city. More than half had a mental health disorder, and 30% were addicted to drugs or alcohol. Here's Christy Holderegger. She is the president and CEO of Volunteers of America, the shelter operator.
Somebody didn't become homeless overnight. And so coming in, it's not going to be housed again overnight. It's a process. And so there's lots of different barriers that we're looking at. And a lot of it is around the trauma that they've experienced. And that trauma can have started when they were a child. It could have been through their service as a veteran. It could be just a variety of different things that have to be addressed. There's a lot of assessment that needs to be done, and that individual needs to be a part of the plan to what their full potential will look like.
And I would imagine further compounding these challenges, I mean, given that the X Street shelter opened 2 years ago, we were in the middle of the pandemic. So how did that public health crisis impact the shelter and really its ability to connect people with housing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pandemic definitely slowed things down, just like it slowed down so many other things in our world. It made things much more difficult. During the shelter's first year, only about one quarter of the guests found housing. And again, that percentage has increased as time has gone on, closer to 35%. Sarah O'Daniel is the director of homeless innovations for the city's housing authority. And she talked about COVID's impact on the shelter's housing goals.
When you're with COVID, everything really does shut down, right? The landlords aren't showing units. You cannot go out. You're not going to have the staff that are going to be there to actually take our guests to see the housing. Everything shut down. And so having a goal that might have been put in place a while back, we really can't compare it.
And just to add to this point about COVID, the shelter's director, Amanda Byard, told me in an interview that more than half the shelter's 25 staff members came down with COVID early on. So they were dealing with some huge staffing and health challenges right from the start.
Yeah, wow. Chris, when you actually toured the shelter, you also spoke with some of the residents. I mean, tell us about them.
Sure. I spoke with 54-year-old Stephanie Hoffman. She's been at the X Street shelter since July with her dog, Unique. Before that, she spent more than a decade living unhoused on the American River. And Hoffman is an example of someone at the shelter who does have income and documents in order. But even with those, it's still taking months for her to find housing. When I spoke with her late last month, she was on a wait list. I think Hoffman is also an example of someone at the shelter with a dream for the future. Here's part of our conversation.
What would your ideal picture be for the next, 6 months or whatever?
That tomorrow I get a call about a place. That'd be the ideal place. But
are you looking for like an apartment or?
Well, what I really want to do in the very, very end, what I would really like to do is start some type of nonprofit where I can have like some property where homeless dogs, like people go to jail, they go to the hospital, they die. And there's all these dogs that are like left where, and have somewhere where they can go, like a shelter for dogs.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, that's what my big dream would be.
You know, going forward, the shelter is hoping to expand its kennel space, and that might not seem like a big change, but really could make a difference in convincing unhoused residents who own pets to give the shelter a try. I spoke with Pitbull Dave Chapman about this topic. He's a Vietnam veteran. He spent decades unhoused, and now he works at the shelter as an outreach specialist.
If you're homeless and you have a dog, you will not come in here if you don't camp in your dog. People will not leave their animals to somebody else to watch, and they come in here by themselves. They feel guilty leaving the dog alone.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that's the problem we have, is that a third of people that's homeless out here have a pet of some sort, and we only got room for 10% of them.
Yeah, that really is a crux of the issue, because that's a source of like really deep companionship, during these times. You know, Chris, before we're going to get into like the really pressing issue the neighbors of the shelter have been dealing with, because there are homes and businesses that are surrounding the X Street Navigation Shelter. But overall, when you touch base with city officials and staff 2 years later, are they optimistic that a greater share of guests will find housing in the future?
I think that they're guardedly optimistic. They are hoping that the partnership agreement signed last year by the city and county will bring more mental health services to the shelter. They're also hoping that as time moves forward, they'll be able to establish stronger relationships and trust between staff and guests, and that more affordable housing units will come online. Of course, the lack of affordable housing was cited by several people I spoke with as that one additional and very large barrier to the rehousing efforts. One more note on what's happening inside the X Street shelter. The city council in September approved $4.6 million in funding to keep the shelter open for a third year.
Well, outside of the shelter, I mean, there have been complaints from neighbors. There are homes there and businesses as well about the homeless encampments that until recently they lined the streets and the sidewalks outside of the X Street shelter. What's the latest on that?
Right. This really came to a boil late this summer when council member Katie Maple spoke out about the problem at a public meeting. She said she'd been flooded with complaints from the surrounding neighborhood about these illegal encampments. Maple lives two blocks from the X Street shelter and represents the neighborhood. She told me the city had broken a promise it made to the community about keeping the area clear of these camps, a promise that was made as plans for the new shelter were proposed. Not long after she spoke out, the city removed those camps near the shelter. The majority of people living in them accepted shelter at sites around the city, including at Sacramento's sanctioned campsite at Miller Park. That's according to Beyer, the X Street Shelter's director.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Chris Nichols, CAP Radio's homelessness and housing affordability reporter, about the success of Sacramento's X Street Shelter, as well as the barriers that remain to get people into affordable housing. You know, as we've documented many times, Chris, Sacramento has the region's largest unhoused population. But there are other cities that are trying to find answers for their own unhoused residents. The city of Elk Grove in Sacramento County is trying something new. What is the city doing?
That's right. Last week, Elk Grove opened a winter homeless shelter in their Old Town district, and it's officially called the Enhanced Winter Sanctuary. It's the first time the city of Elk Grove has funded a shelter for people experiencing homelessness. And city officials say that residents ask them for something longer term, more consistent. So the city's working with a Roseville-based nonprofit called The Gathering Inn to operate the shelter. It's a 24/7 operation. It can serve up to 30 adults at one time, and it will remain open through March.
Given that this is a first for the city of Elk Grove, you know, maybe there are people who don't typically think of the city as having a problem with homelessness. Has the city witnessed an increase in their unhoused population?
That's right. It's really not thought of that way. And I spoke with Elk Grove's housing manager, Sarah Bontrager, about that. Here is what she told me.
We've had a fairly consistent population of folks. At any given time, we estimate that we have between 100 and 150 people experiencing homelessness. And that's a mix of folks who are living outdoors and those who are living in vehicles. We do recognize, of course, that winter is a really hard time. The cold winter months are very difficult to be outdoors or in a vehicle. And so the goal of this shelter was to offer a consistent place for folks to stay during those months and offer some services that will hopefully help to connect them with housing while they're in the shelter.
You know, unlike most shelters in the region, you can't just walk up and enter the X Street shelter in Sacramento or this new Elk Grove shelter. They are referral-only facilities.
Mm. You know, before we let you go, Chris, when it comes to the Elk Grove shelter, what services will they provide?
Right. Well, officials say that it will offer case management, substance use treatment, and mental health treatment all on site. They also say that the shelter, they'll have a mental health professional there, staff members who will help guests make employment and housing connections.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Vicki.
Chris Nichols is Cap Radio's homelessness and housing affordability reporter. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The forecast is that El Nino is making a comeback this winter, and that can conjure up memories of powerful winter weather in California, and for good reason. The winters of 2015, 2016, 97, 98 are among the strongest El Ninos on record, with devastating consequences. But predicting the strength of this climate pattern is actually more complicated and uncertain than looking to the past. According to NOAA, El Nino actually dates back to the 1600s, when South American fishermen noticed periods of unusually warm water in the Pacific Ocean. They named the phenomenon El Niño de Navidad, the little boy of Christmas, because it typically peaked around December. Some 400 years later, though, there's still a great deal that we don't know. While some climate models are predicting a super El Niño this winter, others aren't as certain. And even if it is a strong El Nino, it doesn't mean we're going to feel that impact in Northern California. Paul Ulrich is a professor of regional and global climate modeling at UC Davis and joins us with how big of a role El Nino plays in wintertime precipitation in California. Good morning, Professor Ulrich.
Good morning.
So for those who need a refresher, how often does El Nino or California experience El Nino?
So the El Nino cycle is somewhat variable, but in general, we expect El Ninos to pop up basically every 7 to 10 years or so.
Got it. What are the conditions that lead to an El Nino event?
So El Ninos are associated with anomalously warm temperatures in the equatorial Pacific region. And so under typical conditions, we have relatively modest temperatures in this region, with warmer temperatures more in the Western Pacific. But the El Nino is associated with basically this shift in temperatures towards the east. And it basically comes about because of a complicated interaction between the atmosphere and ocean states.
In the recent weeks, I would say the last month or two, I mean, there have been some climate models that are forecasting El Nino for this winter. NOAA's predicting or favoring a strong event from November through January. The National Center for Atmospheric Research is predicting a super El Nino this winter that rivals 97 and 98. But when you see these models and these forecasts, what do you keep in mind?
So the way that NOAA does it is we rely on basically a large spread in a large selection of different models effectively in order to run these simulations in order to try to predict the future. There's all sorts of differences in terms of the way that these models are built and the way that they incorporate the physics of the real world that causes basically a spread in their projections. So inevitably, you'll have some projections that are higher than normal and higher than what we observe and some that are going to be lower than what we observe. What we generally look to is kind of the middle of that pack, and in order to basically get our best projection of where things are headed. Well, we have some models, of course, that have that are predicting kind of this extreme or super strong El Nino event. There's also others that are predicting a relatively modest event. And while we can be anywhere in the spread, there's always some probability associated with some of the most extreme conditions or some of the weaker conditions. In general, we're anticipating this to be basically a relatively modest to strong El Nino.
How quickly can predictions and forecasts change? I mean, did they change from September to October?
We've seen this coming for a little while now. We're basically coming off of a period of relatively persistent La Niña conditions, where you have cooler temperatures in the equatorial eastern Pacific. And as a consequence, it generally, based on the timing of El Niño and its relative periodicity, that is its reliability, we can anticipate that this season was basically primed for the emergence of El Niño conditions. However, as we get closer and closer towards the winter season, that allows us to get a better gauge on how strong the particular El Niño event will be.
Yeah, since we're coming off of an already powerful and destructive winter season with a series of atmospheric rivers at the beginning of the year, you know, was last winter, was that connected to a pattern like El Niño or La Niña?
Interestingly, the last winter was relatively neutral conditions. That's basically a state in between La Niña and El Niño. So the equatorial Pacific didn't play a huge role. When it comes to California, our precipitation that we receive every season is highly variable. There's a lot of uncertainty associated with how much we receive, and a lot of it is basically probability, roll of the dice to see how much rain we receive.
The most recent strongest El Niños on record, I believe, was 2015-2016. It wasn't that long ago. What were the conditions that led to that strength?
So that was, again, a relatively strong El Niño that emerged after several years of La Niña conditions. And sometimes you just get basically this perfect concordance between the atmosphere and ocean that allows these very strong El Niños to develop.
Hmm. Given that when we think of El Niño, we connect it to California, but is it that widespread of an event, or does it impact some parts of the state more than others?
Well, it's certainly widespread in the sense that it has global consequences associated with it. California is not the only part of the U.S. that actually experiences oscillations in its weather because of an El Niño or La Niña state. Actually, much of the southern U.S., particularly from Texas to Florida, they experience increase in wetness as well during these El Niño conditions. Also, because of increases in wind shear that typically occur during El Niño, we see a reduction in the typical number of tropical cyclones that we see coming to that area. So El Niño in California, though, does tend to have a stronger connection to the southern part of the state. That is, we can see more deviation from kind of our average amounts of precipitation per year in Southern California when we have an El Niño event than in Northern California.
Hmm. So given that last winter, you know, wasn't connected to an El Niño or La Niña event, it was actually like pretty stable in terms of the forecast and the modeling. Was last winter a surprise seeing these atmospheric rivers come through our area?
I would say it was both a surprise and not a surprise. In some sense, it was a surprise because actually back in September of 2022, NOAA had actually predicted that last winter would be relatively dry. And I got myself into a little bit of trouble because actually the Farmer's Almanac at that time had also said that winter would be relatively wet. However, I don't think that that's necessarily a reflection on our ability to forecast the amount of precipitation associated with these events, but instead it just speaks to the fact that there's a lot of variability. When it comes to an El Niño, the actual shift in total precipitation that we're expecting over this coming year is on the order of 2 to 3 inches of additional precipitation. And just to contrast that with how much California normally gets, we're usually in like the range of 30 to 70 inches of precipitation. So a 2 to 3 inch shift towards wetter conditions isn't really that big of a shift overall.
You know, what I'm learning is that even though over the decades and in centuries, you know, modeling and technology has improved, there's still just a lot of anomalies out there that do create some unpredictability when it comes to forecasting, you know, what we're talking about in this case, El Niño, and the severity of it.
Yeah, the global weather system is inherently chaotic. There are limitations to how far in the future we can predict weather, basically, as a consequence of the inherent chaos that exists within the atmosphere. And that limits many of our forecasts to being essentially no better than guesswork after about 2 weeks. With that said, we can still latch onto these persistent oceanic conditions and see how they do manifest in terms of shifts in total precipitation amount. So El Niño conditions does lead to an increase in the probability of wetter conditions, but it's in no means a guarantee of having wetter conditions.
What role does a warming climate play in El Niño winters?
In terms of the warming climate, there's been a lot of research in terms of the climate influence on El Nino, and there's still not really a solid scientific consensus on whether or not climate change itself is enhancing the frequency or the intensity of El Nino against the background. That being said, we are seeing warming oceanic temperatures. We're seeing a warming atmosphere, which means that the atmosphere itself is able to hold more moisture overall. When it holds more moisture, that means that when we have these extreme precipitation events, these extreme rainfall events and snowfall events from atmospheric rivers, they typically have more precipitation associated with them, more rainfall and more snowfall. So the atmospheric rivers individually are becoming more extreme, but we're not necessarily seeing an increase in the number of them.
Hmm. Finally, what are you going to be watching for in the climate modeling and forecasts in the coming weeks and months?
I'm going to keep my eyes peeled on the NOAA climate forecast. I'm going to keep my eyes peeled on kind of our short-term forecasts as well. You should never neglect these 1 to 2 week outlooks, I suppose, on the weather, just in order to see when it's going to rain. Hopefully, like last year, we don't have every weekend, it felt like, basically being sacrificed to rain. But we'll see how it plays out.
Professor Ulrich, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Paul Ulrich is a professor of regional and global climate modeling at UC Davis and is explaining how big of a role El Nino plays in wintertime precipitation in California. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. So you might think this year's wildfire season is a closed chapter, but history would caution otherwise. Tomorrow marks 5 years since the Camp Fire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history. And in Southern California, the 2017 Thomas Fire is among one of the largest and most destructive in state history, and that ignited in December, as well as the 2018 Woolsey Fire, which ignited the same day as the Camp Fire. They are all sobering reminders that wildfires can defy seasons and be year-round. Craig Clements is the director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State University and joins us with a clearer picture of where things stand so far this year. Thank you for joining us, Professor Clements.
Thanks for having me.
So is wildfire season over for you this year?
For me? Well, I don't think it's over yet. We are in better shape. It's getting very close, though, because Northern California, we just had this recent rain. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just had the Highland Fire in Riverside County last week. So if we look at fire danger across the state, Northern California is very, very low in most of the regions, but Southern California is moderate to higher. So Southern California is not out of fire danger or out of the fire season. Northern California is coming to a close, but that could change as well.
Is that why, when you look back at 2017 with the Thomas Fire, that was in Southern California and it ignited in December? Is the southern part of the state, does a wildfire season go later into the fall and even into potentially the winter?
Yeah, it can. It just depends on if we have fall precipitation events. That can really, and depending on the amount of precipitation, it really can shut down fire season. So if Northern, you know, we've had a couple of cold fronts come through this season so far in Northern California. And as a result, the fire risk is very low. That changes day to day. And what people need to realize is that if we get, like, you know, a warming trend, the fire danger will change. And if we get cooler, wetter weather, that will then decrease the fire risk. So it just depends on the day-to-day weather through this period of time in the late fall.
How would you characterize this year so far?
We were well below average, as you probably know, with just close to about 300,000 acres burned across the state. That is significantly lower than what we've seen in our previous years of, you know, millions of acres in a fire season. I think we had that wet winter that we were just talking about, and last year was very fortunate for us because it allowed the fuel moistures to remain high. They're actually still above normal for this time of year, which is decreasing the fire risk for much of the state, particularly Northern California.
Hmm. Why is fuel moisture so important and how is it measured?
Yeah, so the fuel moisture content is the amount of water inside a plant. And we use that as a metric for flammability, so how easy a plant will ignite. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to measure this stuff because you have to go out into the field and take clippings. And this is done across the state from a number of agencies, including San Jose State. We have a long-term site. Cal Fire has a number of sites. And then the utilities, PG&E, Southern California Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric, they all have a number of sites. So we're talking probably about over 100 sites that are sampled twice a month. Regularly, like on the 1st and on the 15th. And so we go out, we do the clippings, we bring those back into the lab, we weigh them, and then we dry them. And we typically sample chamise and some sage and manzanita. And so it's we stick to the same type of plants around the state. And that way we can get a climatology of what the plants are doing and how they're responding to the current weather and to the precipitation from the previous year.
So given,
and so, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so given that fuel moisture is looking good this year, I mean, is that the biggest role that plays into a relatively mild wildfire year this year? You mentioned 300,000 acres that have burned year to date for this year. Last year, it was like around the same, I think 280,000 acres year to date in 2022 compared to the 5-year average of like 1.5 million acres. Is fuel moisture, you know, the biggest reason why we have had a reduction in acres burned in the last 2 years?
It's one of the reasons. And if we think about the what we call the fire behavior triangle, where we look at weather, the fuels, and topography. And obviously in California, most of our wildfires are in steep terrain, which makes it difficult to suppress them, and they can burn faster in steep terrain as well. But it's the weather component that is the most variable. And so that's not only includes just day-to-day, if it's windy, hot, and dry, or if it's cool and moist. It's also the seasonal characteristics. So if we had a very wet spring, if we had a cooler summer, that plays in the role in drying those fuels. But the fuel moisture content, if the fuels are really wet, you're not going to be able to burn it. And I like to use, when I teach wildfire science at San Jose State, I use an analogy, and we do this experiment where we go out and try to start a campfire. If you try to start a campfire with wet wood, it's very hard to light and it burns at low intensity. But if you have very, very, very dry fuels, very, very dry wood, and you try to light that fire, it's going to ignite much easier. So it's the same thing in the wildland. It's the same thing with our fuels in the forest. Like if they're wet, they're going to burn at a lower intensity.
So that all sounds great. I mean, we have good fuel moisture. We had less acres that were burned this year and last year compared to the 5-year average. And then even an update from the U.S. Drought Monitor last week, I believe, you know, all of California is currently free from drought conditions. So all of this sounds good. But are we missing something when we just take into account historical averages and drought monitoring?
Well, yeah, because if you think about 2020, our biggest fire season on year, where we had thousands of ignitions across the state, all within a week or within a couple of days. And we had, you know, the CZU complex, the SU complex, a number of large fires burning across the state. That was a result of not only did we have dry fuels from the preceding year, but we had a heat wave the week before we had a lightning outbreak. That combination just lined up perfectly where we had very large fires. So it is day-to-day weather. Another thing that we, especially in the fall, and particularly in both Northern and Southern California, we have our offshore wind events. In Northern California, we call those North Winds or Diablo Winds. In Southern California, they are the Santa Anas. And so the wind events really can drive extreme fire behavior, even if the plants are not totally moist, if they're a little drier. You get a big wind, you can still drive fire. But in reality, as long as the fuels are moist, fire management agencies and firefighters can be able to handle those fires a lot easier because they're not going to burn as intensely. So they can get containment much quicker.
We were just having a conversation about El Nino. What impact of this year's El Nino do you think will it have on the tail end of this wildfire year going into the next?
Well, if we get some storms coming in, as we should, hopefully, in November, well, then that will really shut down fire season across the state, depending on where that precipitation is. And if the El Nino is moderate to high, then we're going to get higher precipitation across the mountains throughout the whole winter. So next season, we could be set up for a lower than average wildfire year. So that would be good. It all depends on how much rain and when it comes, because sometimes we can get rain throughout the winter and then the whole spring is dry and warm, and that can set us up for, you know, maybe a little bit earlier fire season. Whereas this last season, this 2023 summer, we didn't have a lot of ignitions all through summer, and wasn't until late summer that we got ignitions and bigger fires. And that's because we had a lot of rain. Everything was so moist. We had so much snowpack. I mean, Tioga Pass didn't open up until July. We had lots of snow in the High Sierra, right? So that was an anomaly year. Hopefully it sets up the same way as it did this year.
So as we're getting to cooler temperatures, we've had some rain already so far in the last month or so. What do you want people to keep in mind when it comes to managing wildfire risks?
Well, if you are living in the wildland-urban interface or out in the mountains in a high fire risk zone, please be mindful that the vegetation around your property plays a big role in your ability for your house to ignite. So keeping pine needles off your roofs, out of your gutters, keeping things away from, keeping clear 5 feet from the base of your home, keeping vegetation managed around your property is really important, even if it's a wet year, and managing that throughout the whole season.
Professor Clements, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Clements is the director of the Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Center at San Jose State University, discussing this year's wildfire season. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. An annual holiday tradition is returning to the streets surrounding Sac State's campus. Run to Feed the Hungry is the largest Thanksgiving Day fun run in the country. And this year, it returns for its 30th year. What started as hundreds of participants has now grown into an event with tens of thousands of runners and walkers. But the run is not only a fun way to burn off some calories before having a Thanksgiving Day feast, it also supports a local nonprofit working to fight hunger and food insecurity in the region, a crisis that has increased dramatically since the pandemic began. Blake Young is the president and the CEO of the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services and joins us with more about the upcoming run and walk and how it'll help feed Sacramentans in need. Good morning.
Good morning.
30 years. Can we go back to year one and how this all got started?
You bet. Yeah, 1994, Father Madigan, who was our founder, got together with some volunteers and some local runners and had this idea to let's have this event on Thanksgiving. And everybody thought he was crazy because it's Thanksgiving and no one would come out. And, you know, fast forward 30 years, he was genius. I mean, people, because it was Thanksgiving, this was an opportunity to create a tradition, to kind of give thanks in another way and to kind of eat guilt-free. So it's grown out of that. And I just think, you know, at some point it's become the perfect event for people in Sacramento.
Why do you think it has grown to the scale that it has grown over, you know, the last three decades? I mean, from several hundred people, you know, less than 1,000 the first year to now, I think it was like over 20,000 the year last Thanksgiving.
Almost 30. 29,600 and some change. I think the day was genius. I think a lot of people were nervous that folks would be tied up, and I think the day represents family. It represents gratitude for our organization and the people that support it on the day and every day. It's a chance just to think about other folks, a chance for a minute to think what would life be like if I couldn't afford a Thanksgiving meal. And I think people have rallied around that, and we're blessed enough to be a long-standing organization in town. And I think people really value the work that we do. And again, I think it's about giving thanks.
I've spoken to the Sacramento Family Food Bank, you know, since the pandemic started in 2020 and doing check-ins year after year. Now that we're in 2023, where does that need stand now? Because it grew exponentially during COVID.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the need has never been larger. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be with the organization 26, almost 27 years. And in 2008, you can remember the recession. The demand for food resources really went high, and it never really went down. But just to put it in context, we were providing food to roughly 150,000 people the day before COVID hit. 2 months into COVID, we were at 300,000. We have not gone down. So if you think about the population of Sacramento County, there's, you know, almost a quarter of the people in our county are food insecure, and it's only getting worse.
And I bring that up because the Run to Feed the Hungry, I mean, it is a great tradition for families and for people to do on Thanksgiving, but it's also your largest fundraiser.
It is. And again, we're blessed to have the community support, blessed to have you guys as support. And, you know, but it does represent a significant portion of our budget. And we're just, you know, thankful that so many people come out. But it is a real fundraiser. We're lucky in that we own and manage the event. A lot of runs throughout the country, the nonprofit is just the beneficiary. So there's a lot of cost controls that we can implement and keep. And we've tried to do that over the years, maximize potential revenue, which is not the word you usually use for nonprofit. But when you're feeding 300,000 people yeah. a month, it's significantly expensive.
And it's not just food in terms of the services that you provide. I mean, what does this fundraising event, what does it help fund for those nearly 300,000 people?
Yeah, great question. The majority of the money that we spend, people would be surprised, is buying food. Period. I mean, a lot of folks think that there's a misconception that we get all donated food. We have wonderful donors, grocery chains, et cetera. But food banks are scale by a significant portion. In fact, 42% of all the food that we distribute on a monthly basis is fresh produce that's purchased.
Yeah. I mean, 42%, that's nearly half.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our goal, it has been for years, is to provide nutritious food to folks. I mean, just because they're in need of food resources doesn't mean they need to eat Kit Kats and Twinkies. And so we've always put an emphasis on nutritious food. And luckily, our community who supports our food bank really values that. And the end result is small children that are going to school hungry can get nutritious food. Seniors that are making difficult decisions buying medication versus food can get nutritious food. Single moms, believe it or not, tens of thousands that get support from us can have nutritious food for the family. And it's just, for us, it's top priority.
I would imagine there's other items that are essential as well, like diapers.
Well, it's funny that you say. We actually are a diaper bank. There is such thing. There's only a few in the state of California. And so if you think about our food bank, the structure, we're a wholesaler. We provide food to over 130 agencies throughout Sacramento County. But most people don't know that we also supply diapers to 70 other nonprofits throughout the county as well. And we all know, if you've had children, if you've been an aunt or, you know, a grandparent, you know how expensive diapers are. So it's wonderful that we're in a position to be able to supply those for our community.
Hmm. Okay, so let's get to the fun run on Thanksgiving Day. What does the course look like? Where does it start? It starts at Sac State, correct?
Yeah, it starts at Sac State and it ends basically at Scottish Rite or Fremont Presbyterian Church on 8th Street in Carlson. Beautiful East Sac neighborhood. I think part of the draw is that people really enjoy the event. Most people might not know this, but 85 to 90% of people that do the event are walkers or strollers. They're not timed participants. I just think people, you know, enjoy going through the neighborhood. We now have over 12 bands on the course.
Oh, great.
Right? Neighborhood
like
bands.
Like a party.
It is a party. So if you want to jump on the event and go through East Sacramento and drink a mimosa, you can do that too.
What time do things get started?
Yeah, so our 10K is at 8:30 in the morning on Thanksgiving, and our 5K is at 9 o'clock sharp. And again, most folks are finished with the event by 11 o'clock, and they're back home, and they're starting to cook and enjoy their family.
I would imagine, since you mentioned strollers, there's not an age requirement. It's all ages?
It's all ages, and I think one of the things most important to us is folks that cannot make it to the event, they can register as a virtual participant. We can also mail your T-shirt and your bib. But it's just a wonderful way to say, my husband dragged us to Minneapolis this year because we have family there as well. But we're still going to support the organization, do the Run to Feed the Hungry.
That's great. And so can you sign up to that day? Because I know you can sign up now.
Yep, you can sign up all the way until race day. You'll pick up your T-shirt and bib at Fremont Presbyterian Church starting on Saturday, November 18th, and it runs all the way through race day.
You know, the fact that you said race day, you know, it was actually, I mean, every time I take in Run to Feed the Hungry, I mean, you just see people of all ages, you know, they just fill like J Street and the surrounding streets in East Sacramento, but there is actually a race. There is like people that actually do get a first, a second, a third, and they are quite fast. I was looking at the times from last year, and there are some prizes, you know, for those people.
Yeah, there's prizes. And, you know, a lot of people do this as a warm up to the CIM and or a warm down, if you will, from the New York City. We have some people that did the New York City Marathon recently. In fact, we had one of our staff members do it. They use that as kind of a precursor. But there are some significantly trained athletes to go out and try to win prize money and first, second, third, as you said. But by far, the majority of people are jogging or strolling or they're just trying to make it to the end having fun.
You don't got to run a 420 mile.
You do not have to run a 420 mile.
You can walk a 20-minute mile or even longer.
That sounds like my pace.
Yeah, me as well. I'm in the same boat as you. You know, when I look at the photos from the website, I mean, it's so striking, you know, how many people take part in this. Why is it so important to have such a visible presence? I mean, tens of thousands of people, 29,000 and change, you know, getting together for something like this.
Well, I think, you know, we have a significant homeless situation in our town and many other towns, and that's very visible. But hunger is not. You don't know. You'd be surprised at how many people that aren't very far away from you that are struggling. Mm-hmm. And this event, God bless it, is a nice platform for our organization to talk about hunger issues. And it's also an opportunity for people that do the event to just, you know, give thanks for what they have. It's a day of gratitude. And it's also a day for families to get together and just talk about that table issue that's really, really important, but also it's prevalent in our community.
Given that last year you were flirting with 30,000 participants, how are things looking this year?
Well, we're looking good. I think, you know, part of it is that, you know, we have a price increase, and I think a lot of people got in under the radar there. We are looking good. We're up a little bit. I think it would just, you know, we've had a goal to reach 30,000 people, and ironically, this is the 30th year, so we're going 30 for 30. We're hoping that maybe if people can't make it, they sign up virtually, and it's kind of a fun little inside, let's try to get to 30,000. We're just blessed to have as many people do the event as they do.
Blake, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Blake Young is the president and the CEO of the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services, the organization behind the annual Run to Feed the Hungry. And as Blake said, it is the 30th annual race and their goal, 30,000 participants. It takes place this Thanksgiving Day. And that is it for Insight. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. You can also email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Claire Morgan. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. And our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.